like under a tenth of a wavelength. As far as the RF is concerned, that's a solid sheet of metal, and it won't flow through there. So your fence can be chain link or solid metal, and on 40 meters, it'll be the same. On 10 gigahertz, it'll be different. On 10 gig, a chain link fence, the holes are big enough, the signal will flow through the holes, because it's only a 1-inch wavelength. So this will help you get a little bit of a feeling for why the fence is an extremely minor perturbation to an HF operation. Now, when it comes to setting up loop antennas, I'm not convinced the fence is going to buy you anything.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because in my opinion, the first thing you have to do with a loop antenna to be resonant, to be operative on any of these HF frequencies, the first thing you got to do is resonate the loop. If the loop doesn't resonate, as an antenna, it's going to be a zillion dB down in performance. Once you hit resonance, and once the loop is made out of reasonably conductive materials with the right kind of impedance matching device, now it's going to give you all of the gain it's supposed to give you. And here, common sense is going to lead you astray. You would think a loop that's only a tenth of a wavelength in diameter, but resonating, you would think it's going to have 1/100th the area of a full one wavelength loop, one wavelength diameter loop, and therefore you would think it's going to have 20 dB less gain. It can have the identical gain or a little bit more. Mel's going to give you a couple of words on that. He's read the right chapter in the antenna handbook from ARRL on loop antennas that most people ignore, and the small loop antenna he puts in the shack with him, in many cases in receiving mode, is giving him considerably more performance than his full 260-foot-long wavelength circumference diameter loop, full wavelength loop, 40 feet in the air in his backyard. So give him a few of your magic words on this one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
May I cut in?
Somebody want to ask a question first?
Yes, actually, well, thank you, RIW. Very, very, very clear and concise information. And forget the timing out of the computer. Indeed. Yeah, it's probably psychological. I see the metal fence, and I think, oh my God, it produces some kind of a blockage. But intuition tells me something else works, because I built a little loop for my Grundig shortwave radio, pickup radio Vanna Cuba and Radio Netherlands. It's great on it. So I know something's going. I want to make this thing work. I want to optimize my setup. So if you guys can help me, I would appreciate it. So I will feed, and please, I'm listening.
Mel's your man. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, first of all, the loop that you're most likely talking about, I have two loops, actually three loops, but one loop outside is my transmitting loop. That's 272 feet of wire on four support. I would assume that you're really interested in, as Dick says, the receiving loop that I am using right now, which is less than a tenth of a wavelength in size. Is that exactly what you're planning to try to experiment with, a receiving loop? The one I built is for 80 meters. There's another version I've seen, but the original version was for 160, really was to be able to null out broadcast interference. But it's a very sharp antenna, and, well, it's practical to build one if you're going to use it inside the shack for 80 meters. Is this what you're thinking over?
Thank you very much, Lou and group. Let me discuss the situation. I'm on the 6th and tile floor of an apartment building, which is in the upper part of Manhattan here. I'm high above the Hudson, probably about 160 feet. So I want to take advantage of what's available to me. I have permission from the neighbor to stretch a wire. I can probably put up a Marconi or Zappa sometime. In other words, I want to take advantage of the available enclosure space, okay? Not a big theorist, mind you, but I'd worried about the fence. So I could put up, right now I have a 185-foot Boston set dipole, ladder line fence, working fantastically with an old-fashioned rig, right, an old hybrid rig. But I want to optimize what I have here now, and indeed, for receiving. For receiving characteristics, I think it'd be best to quiet down the receiving. But without some serious analysis, which I don't know about, and antenna modeling, it's kind of hard to do. I'm glad you guys, let me let this drop. I'm glad you guys have told me that at HF frequency, the skill fence is really something you're not considering. So I had the opportunity to put up a leg that's 50 foot, and a leg that's 200 foot, and it could enclose an area that's in square foot, I imagine about like, you know, 2060, you know, probably full 160, but I need some help in terms of optimizing the design and actually asking if it's really worthwhile doing. So I hope that makes sense, and I pass it back to you, Ruth. WP7ADM.
Well, name is Mel, by the way, Mike Echo. The only thing maybe we're getting a little confused here. The receiving loop that I'm using sits in the shack. It's not sitting on a tripod. It's approximately 12 feet in circumference. It's built in the shape of a diamond. What you are looking for is, like I am using outside, that's the transmitting loop, which is just a big rectangular type of antenna. It's actually 272 feet of wire, but it's fed with open wire feeders and all. Not really a resonant antenna to speak of. Goes into a balanced antenna tuner. And works quite well if you can manage that. There are all kinds of versions of it. This one happens to be in the rectangular type of shape, but there are delta loops and things of that sort. I think maybe that's what you're looking for, not the receiving loop that I'm using inside the shack, if I'm correct, over.
Yes, indeed. You're making sense now. I mean, excuse me for the confusion. Yeah, a trapezoid or a delta would be great, because I can find a far attachment point and then the points around on the building. I guess bottom line was there, Mel, I was concerned about the metal fence, and both you and RIW Dick answered my question that really it's not a big factor. And maybe, not trying to be Mr. Appliance Operator here, I've proved that because I've done really well with my optimal foot dipole. I have a 135 foot dipole, and I've tweaked on it many, on many occasions. And that fence makes no difference. It seems to me what makes a difference here is the orientation of that building in terms of the geographical space on planet Earth, right? I work well into the Midwest and to Europe. So in any case, it's intriguing and interesting. So I want to optimize my location, both for transmitting and receiving, and would appreciate any tips. And my other question, not to belabor the point, was how to use modeling software. I'm new to it, you know. I find it somewhat confusing, so I wouldn't say baffling. I can figure it out, but, you know, I want to learn how to use it in an effective manner for my situation, too. So I'll pass it back to you now, and appreciate your ideas. And by the way, your QTH is Brooklyn, right? WB7ADM.
Roger. I'm in Brooklyn. I'm in the southern end of Brooklyn here, right near the Atlantic Ocean, about 350 feet most of the time from the Atlantic Ocean, HI. And the best thing for you to do, we've discussed this loop and versions of it many, many times here on TechNet. So I think the best thing is for you to go to the discussions we've had in the past and use the references and all, because it's quite an extensive subject that Vic was mentioning. That we've been working with this and discussing it and experimenting for the last couple of years with loop technology, of antenna loop and technology, both outside and inside receiving loop. So if you go, have you ever gone to our amateurradio.tv and listened to any of the previous discussions we've had on loops, over?
I have not. I've only seen a landmark link, and I shall join shortly. But again, time will take it. I will not belabor the point, and we'll do, okay, guys? And it's appreciated, and also fascinating the conversation on eclipses and the metaphysical discussion regarding astronomy and those things, okay? I appreciate it greatly, okay? You're talking to a guy who's a musician here with some engineering background, of course, you know, CFEQ and some math, basically, and music, so appreciate it. WB7ADF will look up those links, intelligently and enjoys very much listening to this fabulous TechNet. Thanks, Mel, and thanks, Jake. And I will say 7-3 and be on the side.
Yeah, I'm going to say a couple words to him on this one, Mel. You use good common sense, Rob, and you assume that if you go to the Limark TechNet, that you'll read about what Mel and I have said in the past. Good assumption, not quite true. There's an extremely enthusiastic guy in New Jersey, KC2NJI, Mike Perry, who has for years now been recording these hours and hours of TechNet, and he has presented them on a website. That website is amateurradio.tv. www.amateurradio, all run together with a double R between amateur and radio, amateurradio.tangovictor. And you go there and you'll see every 5 minutes of these four-hour discussions we have every Sunday night, every 5 minutes, the subject matter being discussed is documented. You go down that list and find the places where we've been discussing loop antennas, and you'll get the equivalent of 30,000 words on the subject if it was written all down. That's a resource that should be quite helpful to you. But the main thing you're going to discover, and Mel's a little bit too humble to say it, he has discovered something that is darn significant, in my opinion, and that is that we have for years and years forgotten about the fact that when we're on HF and we have what we call a band opening, what that means is the signal is reflecting off the ionosphere. If you had nothing but ground waves, you'd be talking to a guy 30 miles away. But when you get reflection off the ionosphere, you talk to a guy 300, 3,000, and maybe even 25,000 miles away, so to speak, in this long path. The ionosphere is doing that. That's the good news. The bad news is the ionosphere always experiences Faraday rotation. The ionosphere is a plasma media which has the Earth's magnetic field mixed into it. You sit there in Manhattan on top of your six-story apartment building and launch a beautiful horizontally polarized wave toward your buddy in London. By the time the signal reflects once or twice off that ionosphere to get from New York City to London, it has been twisted by Faraday rotation in polarization through that ionosphere two or three times. By the time it gets to London, it may be a vertically polarized signal. And Faraday rotation does not obey the law of reciprocity. So when your buddy in London sends a signal back to you, he sends it back horizontal. It goes through the ionosphere, twists two or three times. And when it gets to New York City, it's horizontal. He launches horizontal, you get horizontal. You launch horizontal, he gets vertical. The ionosphere does that. With Mel's tenth of a wavelength diameter loop, on a truck
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
With Mel's tenth of a wavelength diameter loop, on a tripod, in the shack with him, once he resonates it, he gets at least the full performance of the 260-foot diameter wire, 40 feet in the air. But that loop in the shack with him, he can twist it in azimuth, he can twist it in elevation, he can twist it in polarization. He can match the polarization of that ionosphere during this hour of this day to that signal coming to him from London now. Whereas that 40 foot in the air with four towers on the four corners of that loop in his backyard, he doesn't have that freedom. He at times ends up something like 10 or 12 dB signal-to-noise ratio better on the loop in the shack with him compared to the full whaleboat antenna 40 feet in the air in the backyard. You tell that to the guys on HF, and it sounds crazy, and they say, what the hell are you smoking? He's dead right. They don't believe it. So you're getting some of the benefit of this on what you're hearing. I wonder if that makes some sense, Glenn, before I turn it back over to Mel. Just a further comment. Over to you. I said Glenn, I meant Rob. Over to you, Rob.
Yeah, K2RIWD7ADF, portable too, using the old school signage. Absolutely fascinating, you know, because I got into ham radio when I was a teen back in 75 in Seattle, in Mexico. It's got Mexico as well. And loop antennas do work on receiving. So my intuition tells me this. As a musician, let me tell you guys something. I find it fascinating that atmospheric pressure, you know, temperature changes do affect us, right, in terms of our hearing and everything. Let me just say this. I'm currently rehearsing a piece with I mean, it's a piece, right, guys, with some very lovely musicians from Juilliard and Haskell Music. These girls are picking this music up perfectly right now. And I ask myself, is it the weather? Is it because we're in this transitional period where the climate is cold and hot, snow on the ground? You know, I'm not distracted, right? It has to do with resonance and the way that we can change as in the XY coordinates, XYZ coordinates. I think a lot of it has to do with that, with how we attenuate signals and how we perceive them, you know? If you can have a receiving antenna, when they drop, as signals can be attenuated and be perceived, makes all the difference. I would love to be able to have an optimal loop antenna receiving system and then an appropriate transmit system. So it makes sense. I don't know if I've gone off to do it, but it's always very intriguing because you guys are really within the astronomy, eclipses, fabulous, the multiple layering of space, relative perception of space objects, Moon, Earth, and all this stuff. It's all related, isn't it? Indeed. Now let's not wax philosophical because I know K2RIW will get into this stuff. So let's keep it technical. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I will investigate the topic. WD7ABF monitoring.
KB2YEW.
Okay, YEW recognized. Mel, going to send it back to you for a couple of comments. Then we're going to jump over to the space report because we've been keeping Pearl Paul waiting here. He's got to get up early in the morning. Mel, do you want to put in any closing remarks on loop antennas?
I guess we sort of covered it in detail, as Dick mentioned, that we had not only discussed in detail, but we also have been very surprised at some of the results, as Dick just outlined some of the unusual results. So it's a simple thing to work on. It's not complicated, being that you can actually put the thing together for next to nothing. It only requires some pieces of wood, trim wood that you can get in any of the home type of supply places. A piece of coax and a variable condenser and just twiddle around. And I was truly amazed the first time I did the interest of investigating it when I really heard of these concepts, of which goes way back. I really was totally taken aback when I saw the results. So take a listen to, as Dick said, amateurradio.tv, and I could say really discuss it in depth, and come back and let us know in the future what you think of the information you get from that that site. Okay, yeah, I think let's turn it right over. Well, you want to pick up KB2YEW, and then turn it to Paul. Hang on there, and we'll get to you next.
Yeah, because we're keeping Paul waiting, KB2YEW, if you're asking for a clarification of what you've heard so far, we're going to handle that right now. If you have an additional question, then we're going to go to Paul first and then come back to your question. Is that all right? And please tell us your name, sir. Mr. YEW, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Yes, good evening, Dick, and everybody else out on it. Call here is KB2YEW. Name is Guy, Coney Island, New York. Let's pass it over. I have a totally additional question here. Let's pass it over to, I believe, the station with the satellite net. Let's go there, and then if you can come back to me, we'll appreciate it. KB2YEW listening.
Very fine, Guy. And Paul, you got it, WS2N, our space expert. What's going on out there? And remember, every 2 minutes or so, you got to wait for the beep on this machine or it's going to time you out. You got it, Paul.
Very good, Dick. I know. Something getting used to. Putting on a timer. I think I wanted to mention a couple of things there in regard to the shuttle. Atlantis made it back. We covered that for a couple of weeks. And we successfully installed the Columbus European Space Agency module, this $2 billion room, to the International Space Station. So that went well. landed successfully. I watched that on CNN and recorded it. They happened to mention that it was also the 40th anniversary of the launch of John Glenn when he was first put into orbit, first American to orbit the Earth. Atlantis, Dick, you're going to be happy to find out, is now going to be set up and it's going to get ready for probably a late summer, maybe August launch, to rescue the Hubble spacecraft, to service it for the final time. So Atlantis, now that it's back, will be the spacecraft to do that work. Endeavour is now on the launch pad. That space shuttle 123 will be going up March 11th, and that's going to bring the Kaibo logistics module up to the International Space Station. Another room, let's call it a room. I'm going to change the names of these things. When you're in these things, they have it arranged where they're not round. You've got walls, ceilings, floors. They arrange it like that for the benefit of the astronauts. So it looks more like a room when you're inside. You drop it. That module is being built, or has been built, by the Japanese Space Agency, and that will be their contribution to the 16-country group that is involved in the space station. Another piece of equipment they're going to be bringing up with the Kaibo module is something called the Dextra Robotic System, made by Canada. Now, Canada is the prime builder of any of these robotic arms, the robotic arm and the space shuttle, which has been used ever since I think the third flight of the shuttle system. The company that made the, it's the country that puts in the Canadian arm that comes off the end of the shuttle arm. Now, another 50-foot piece that when they inspect the space shuttle, they're the ones that built that. Canada also contributed the Canada Arm 2, which is presently located on the space shuttle, on the International Space Station. And that's been up there once, I think, 2002. That's the one that could inchworm its way across the space station. It grabs on one side, the opposite side will reach over and make a connection somewhere else, picking up the power at that location, and then releasing itself on the other side, and it actually walks along the space station. That arm is also brought up by the same country, Canada. Now they're going to bring up something called the Canadian Dextra Robotic System. Let's drop it. This is a dual arm setup. It's got more joints on this thing than you can shake the stick out. I counted about 15 of them, seven in each arm, and then one main rotating joint at the base. And this thing is going to have really dexterity. It's going to be able to grab things. It's going to be able to feel what it's grabbing, unbolt things. For instance, a common use will be to remove batteries. A lot of times they'll do a spacewalk and you'll hear what they're doing. And maybe they'll do a little extra get-ahead type of job. They'll be taking out batteries or computers, or they'll be removing things from the outside of the space station, and then relocating them or putting them away somewhere or putting them somewhere else for future use. This thing will be able to do that work. A lot of the spacewalk that will be done in the future will be done by this thing. Yeah, it's got to be mobile. It will be able to be attached to it's got a mobile base system that will be able to attach to the mobile base system, which in turn, that mobile base system attaches to the mobile transport. Mobile transport is like a a track that runs along the length of the space station. You'll be able to move this thing from location to location to do things. You know, this mobile transporter system has been up there for quite a while, too. Like I mentioned with the Canada Arm 2, when that inch warms its way across, it's okay. It can get itself from one end of the station to the other. But by doing that, it can't carry anything with it because one end is always attached and then the other end releases. And it'll get to a certain location, and then it'll be able to do some work, maybe move a module around or something. Well, with the mobile transporter system, they're able to take Canada on to put it on to that. It can carry something from one end of the station to the other, and it's got more of a use. Well, this new Dextra robotic system will be able to also go on a mobile transporter, and we'll be able to go around the space station and do much finer work than the other robotic arms can do. So I thought that'd be interesting to mention there, Dick. A couple of other things for dropping. The Columbus module that was put up there has some antennas on board from the STS-122 mission that just came back, ham antennas, and eventually some ham equipment will be going up there, including some kind of amateur TV, but a digital type of TV. We call it DATV, or digital amateur television, will be eventually located in the Columbus module. One other thing, before I close, is the Ulysses spacecraft. I've been following this spacecraft for years. This thing was put up 17 years ago, and it was only supposed to last about 5 years. And what this spacecraft did was they launched it in the cargo bay of the Discovery back in 1990. And at that time, there was a lot of interest in the Hubble Space Telescope that was going up at the same time. Well, this thing was also put up, and its job was to investigate the sun. It's the only spacecraft that's in a what we call a polar orbit of the sun. Now, to do that, they launched this thing and they sent it out to Jupiter. And you know how they always use the gravitational assist of the planet. Well, they use the gravitational assist of Jupiter, but in a little different way. Instead of gaining speed or trying to completely change its trajectory, its inclination to the Earth, put the plane headed for the pole of Jupiter, and then swung around the North Pole and went into a polar orbit of the sun. It takes 6 years for this thing to go around the sun, so it's made like three passes around the sun, and it'll investigate the northern and the southern poles of the sun. Only spacecraft out there to do something like that. And it's finally going to fail. Let me drop it. On board the power system is starting to deplete. It's got a plutonium heater on it, but apparently it's not throwing off enough heat anymore to keep the fuel warm. It does have hydrazine fuel on board for its attitude thrust, and apparently when it gets too cold, it gets down to like 2 degrees, something in that nature. The lines freeze, the pipes freeze, the hydrazine will stop flowing. So they're going to lose control of the spacecraft probably within a couple of weeks. What they tried to do is divert the energy from the X-band antenna take those 60 watts and put it, you know, for the heat is for the hydrazine. But the power system, that they use for the radio equipment, the power supply failed when they did this. They wanted to bring the X-band back up, didn't come back up, and they found out the power supply failed. Well, the power supply was going to divert its power to the heated for the hydrazine fuel, and that didn't work. So, that doesn't work, things are going to freeze up, one thing led to another. So for the last couple of weeks they've been using the S-band for communication, which they can't get that much information out of that like they get out of their X-band. So they're going to use it for a couple of weeks until it freezes up, and that's going to be the end of that. But they consider it a big success because it was supposed to be a five-year program. They extended it quite a few years, all the way 17 years. People have retired that were involved in this program, and they're still watching this thing go around 17 years later. Maybe. I thought I'd mention that, and that's pretty much it, Dick. Back in it. This is WS2N.
Very nice report, Paul. I got two further questions. Hubble Space Telescope repair going to take place later this summer with Atlantis. I presume the astronauts have been practicing. I'm a little disappointed they're calling it the last repair mission, but I guess it's the last chunk of hardware that's been built to increase its sensitivity, and hopefully they won't have that great big missing piece on the camera, if you know what I mean. Quite a few of the Hubble pictures have a piece missing in the lower left-hand corner because they didn't have the money left over to produce the whole mosaic for the charge couple device sensing section of the camera. And Ulysses sounds like one heck of a mission that I didn't keep track of. Have you any idea what kind of breakthroughs Ulysses has discovered in its 17 or 18 years since launch while doing these polar orbits of the sun? But I presume there's, getting back to Hubble, there's both a couple of new cameras and new inertial wheels, a new computer and new batteries. They're going to replace quite a bit of the hardware up there. It's going to be another one of these missions at least as enthusiastic as the one that Story Musgrave did that really brought it back to life. I wonder if you sense it the same way I do, Paul. WS2N, KQLIW on the TechNet.
Oh, yeah, computers and everything. Yeah, I think they're still running off of 486 computer. Was that one changed out last time? I forgot. I know one time there was an old-time 486 computer that they were using. And new gyros and updated camera system, which is a big deal. Those things are huge. You can take everything apart. And that'll be a couple of week mission. Probably five spacewalks last time I read. Seven person crew, all male. By the way, this next flight that's going up that's going to bring this Japanese module up is all male as well. So is ST-122, so I don't know what's been happening there. Yes, the Ulysses spacecraft, scientists love it. Found helium particles out in deep space. They measured the amount that is in the northern poles, the southern poles. They always wanted to know that. There was a curiosity about the magnetic flux for the north and the south poles of the sun. They were wondering if it was going to be equal on both sides, and they found out that is, in fact, it was equal. They have extremely sensitive detectors on board. It measured the, of course, the solar wind and things like that, what's involved in the north and south. And what's important is the time factor that's involved, is because, you know, you've gone through 17 years, you know, almost two complete cycles of the sun, and they get different readings for different cycles. So it is, people that study the sun loved this Ulysses spacecraft. Just gave them a wealth of information. He was able to detect information from Jupiter when those comets crashed into Jupiter. It was a good location for that, detecting all the different rays and everything coming off the surface and that thing. Dick, I remember that. It's really a science. You know, they love this stuff. This is that, and what's the other one that the European Space Agency called, the Helios.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Okay, thank you. Just a little bit of time out at the end there, Paul. John, good information. And I still think that Hubble repair mission is going to be quite a bit bigger than first anticipated. That's a lot of hardware they're going to change out. And every one of those repair missions, I know that they have to go through quite a bit of rigmarole to close those doors. They have to put a big strap mechanism over them because they don't quite close easily. They don't quite meet the temperature differences in space, so I'm not quite sure what all it is involved there. But how much a Story Musgrove has been involved since he had such a successful repair mission where he combined two missions into one. Hopefully he's helping them learn, you know, every single move they're going to make in space so that it's all done efficiently. Alrighty, we have an additional question by a man from Staten Island, I think it is. no, that's Staten Island. KB2YEW. Go right ahead, Guy, I think it is. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
One website, WS1, quick.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Anybody that's interested in seeing this dextrous manipulator, it's called a special purpose dexterous manipulator is the name of it, built by Canada. I mean, you got to see this contraption. I'll give you the website. It's www.space.gc. That's Gulf Sea. Okay, it's .ca/ASC/IMG. India, my Gulf, /STDM, Sierra Papa, Delta, Mike, -HR, Hotel Romeo, .JPEG, JPG. So, you gotta see this thing. There's more joints in this thing than you could possibly imagine. I cannot imagine how this thing works. But, you know, it's going to work for a long period of time. Looks like too many joints to me, but Canada's very good at this type of thing. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine. Sounds like a fun website to go to. I imagine we could also Google Dextrous and find it by that means if we didn't get all of those individual letters and dashes just right. KB2YEW. Go right ahead, Guy. KQLIW. My name is Dick.
Dick, a long time to find this picture. It wasn't that easy. I tried Google.
I hear you. Let's hope we get it right. You got it, Guy.
Paul, excellent information as always. Dick, thank you. Hate to bring down the TechNet to the infantile stages that I'm going to, but I'm presently working a 40-meter dipole. I just got my general class today. and I'm wondering, okay, I got a couple different questions. I'm looking, I know there's no perfect antenna out there for any band. So I'm looking for something to work 20, 40, and 80 meters. I was looking at the Hustler, I believe it's the HTV or the VTV6, which is a vertical using trap design. I know the trap design has a lot of losses. Any comments or interjections out there, I would love to hear. I'm basically looking for an all-around antenna that I could use for 20 to 80, and something that I'm not going to want to get and like hurl off the roof at the first week. Any comments, I would definitely appreciate. KB2YEW.
Very fine, guy. First of all, well-constructed traps do not have loss. Obvious by the fact you can put a kilowatt into them for 10 minutes and they don't burn up. So everyone thinks they've got loss, they don't. The guys in the Kings County Radio Club, quite a few of them, have used antennas covering 20 to 80 meters. And the president of that club is Mel, K2KEY. So Mel, maybe you can make a suggestion for a guy. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, I am no longer the president. I served 2 terms, that's maximum. So we have to elect a new president, and now I am communications manager. HI. As far as operating those bands, there are a number of verticals, Bushcraft, Hustler, High Gate, and they work fairly well. They are fairly well constructed. Dick says, you know, the traps are very good, IQ traps that work extremely well. So you don't have to be concerned about that. The situation is, if you want to buy one of them, they're costly. Those antennas are gone up tremendously in price, of course, like everything else, but especially, I guess, aluminum, anything, copper, whatever, you know, the materials has increased dramatically. What you can do, I mean, going back to our favorite antenna, the derivation of all antennas, is a dipole. Simple trap dipole may serve your purpose. I'm using, like, for 40, you mentioned 40. I operate a lot of 40 CW. I love 40 CW. And for 40 CW, I use a, well, I guess you can call it almost like a sloper. It's a dipole that has one end tied at 66 feet, and the other end comes down literally to almost to the ground level at about a, taking approximately a 28-degree angle with ground. And, of course, those are antennas that little or no cost, just a wire feed the cable. Work extremely well. You will not be able to find an antenna in that class that will outdo this antenna, okay? And I tell you that exactly. I mean, I'll stand behind that. And like I say, for the buck, for what it costs for the, that type of a dipole in that configuration versus one of these multi-band type verticals, you can well imagine the tremendous difference. So you can have basically a whole bunch of them. Now, you could actually put up a trap dipole, you can buy the trap very economically. I see them advertised in a place called Radio Works and all, and they sell the traps and you roll your own. That may be it. As far as my preference, well, let me drop it. The preference on vertical antennas, the only one that I found that seemed to have something over the others because of its operational type of feed was the is this elevated feed type called the gap antenna. They also very uncostly antenna, but don't use if you appear to trap for some reason. They do not use any traps at all, and it does have some advantage over the other ones because it is a self-contained radial system. Even though these other antennas, they'll claim no radios, yet they sell a radio kit. You'll see all of them have optional radio kits. So that's the only thing I can tell you. The only one I've had experience with is 6BTV, Tesla, and the GAP. The GAP is called the Titan. And both work quite well. I don't know which one will outreach the other, but for my bump, I would go with the dipole, tell you the truth. Let me turn it back to Dick to get his opinion on it. This is KTKY.
Yeah, when you look at these ground plane antennas, Guy, they're very attractive. Some of them have got nice shiny aluminum, all kinds of coils and resonators and doodads on the side and whatever. They look like they're very elaborate, a little bit expensive, and you get the impression you're buying a Cadillac. When you start zooming back and you look at the big picture, you'll suddenly realize that almost all ground plane antennas, quarter wave type ground plane antennas, have a hidden problem. The hidden problem is that in order for the ground plane to give you full performance, you have to lay down a large number of ground plane radials. RF-wise, you're trying to make that backyard of yours look like a solid sheet of copper as far as the RF wave is concerned. You're trying to lay down enough individual ground plane radials such that the wavelength spacing out at the perimeter between the ground plane radials is a small fraction of a wavelength. You succeed in doing that, the wave will think it's on a great big sheet of copper, and it'll give you full performance. The manufacturer doesn't tell you that for a very good reason. Two very good reasons. Number one, let me drop. He knows that people will be discouraged from buying the antenna, that they have to do all of that work to lay down all of the copper ground plane radials. Number two, the average guy cannot measure efficiency of the antenna. He can measure standing wave ratio. He can't measure efficiency. So therefore, if the efficiency is low, the manufacturer doesn't get any flack because of that. Now, what do I mean by inefficiency? If the ground plane radials have got significant gaps between them at your operating wavelength, then a substantial portion of your RF energy gets coupled into Earth, and Earth is an extremely good dummy load. You'll be heating up the soil, you'll keep the worms warm in the wintertime, and they'll be happy. But your RF is being wasted, it does not get out into space. Any of the ground plane antennas that go toward electrical half wavelength, which means elevated feed point, make an improvement. But if you really want to go all the way, you build yourself a trap dipole that is a full half wavelength, vertically polarized trap dipole, and you hang it from a tower that's tall enough, or you use it as a sloper, or you hang it from a tree that is tall enough. Not a popular antenna. It's not much well understood. The best way to make the ground plane equivalent is another quarter wavelength of open-circuited wire, the other half of the dipole. That's what that ground plane radial system is. You put down an infinite number of ground planes. It's trying to act like a mirror, and it's creating the mirror image of the other half of the dipole. But in the process, it's mounted close to Earth, and you end up with inefficiency that is hard to measure. The instrumentation we all own cannot easily measure radiation efficiency. It can only measure VISWR and whether or not the antenna itself gets hot. Whether you're heating up the dirt, let me drop. Which is a whole lot of cubic yards of stuff in your backyard, and that heat is spread out all of those cubic yards, you can't easily measure that temperature. So, no matter how fancy looking and how high in price, no matter how grandiose the claims of a ground plane antenna manufacturer, the way most ground plane antennas are used, the real radiation efficiency is nowhere near as high as you think it is. That's a strongly felt opinion on my part, and maybe Mel, with all of the experiments the guys at the Kings County Radio Club have made, maybe he has seen some confirming evidence of what I'm saying. I'm going to pass it back to Mel. Maybe he wants to add some comments on this one. KTKEY, KTRIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely right, Dick. This is KTKEY. KDY. Nothing beats that basic dipole. And you can make it, like you say, a number of configurations, lower, courtesy, all kinds of configurations. And that shiny antenna that's going to cost you a lot of money today, put it to, I'll put it right next to my common blue dipole that's made with the number 14 stranded electrical wire, not even, you know, anything special, not even any kind of special wire other than what you buy for use in home wiring and conduit. And I'll put that next to that dipole in this sloping type of configuration next to that vertical, and I'm sure that this will do as good or most likely much better. And as Dick says, with the radio situation, that is, presents a problem for a lot of people to get down enough multi-radios, because what you have to do, you have to have different length radios for the different bands. So you have a lot of duplication of radios. And to fan them out properly to get that radiation resistance up, it is a problem, especially with vertical. So for your bang for your buck, you know, like Dick says, you can't beat that dipole. And if you'll go to, like I say, Radio Works, you'll see some really inexpensive dipoles that if you don't want to, you know, a complete kit, they'll send you the wire and everything, insulated and all. But if you have things around like insulated, you don't have to buy them again. Or you can pick them up even at Hamfest like we were at today. They're very cheap. You saw insulated. I saw it up there. These ones made out of Teflon now. They look like the old dog bone insulated, but they are made out of a plastic-like material. Work excellent for 50 cents a piece. I can say the wire is to be purchased fairly reasonable, and if you don't want to roll your own trap, you can buy them, just buy the trap, and that's it. You can use open wire feeders. They sell you, I saw rolls even of it there, very fairly reasonable price, 450 ohm open wire feeders on the other drop. And there it is. You make yourself one heck of an excellent antenna. And let me tell you, other than going into some big type of, you know, Yagi for 40 meters or something, of course, they'll do better. But for average situation, and you are just new into this amateur radio, especially the HF end of it, I would say you cannot go wrong with that dipole. Guess that's the final words on it. Go ahead, Dick.
Mr. 2MIQ, recognized. One other thing I was going to mention to Guy, and that is when you follow the manufacturer's recommendation, which is a very minimum number of ground plane radials, because he doesn't want you laying down a zillion of them, which is really required if you want full performance. This is the best of all worlds. You'd like to lay down 32 ground plane radials. Very few people have got the wherewithal, enthusiasm, property, and whatever to do all that. In that case, I would recommend you lay down all the radials the same length, the full length, for the lowest wavelength. However, if you're only going to put down two radials to each band, then yes, you get the biggest bang out of those two radials by making them quarter wave resonant at that band. But if you lay down enough radials that they're all finely spaced, like 32 of them, and you can lay them all down the full width, don't have to lay down any short ones, because you're trying to make the whole backyard look like a solid sheet of copper. And you don't have to lay down the short ones, in that opinion, in that situation, in my opinion. So you've got a lot of choices when it comes to inexpensive antennas, if you choose to go that way, Glenn. Dipole, sloper, loop, trap dipole, all of these can give a lot of performance for the dollar. A slingshot or a bow and arrow used for throwing the monofilament line and then the rope up above the top of a tree if you've got a local tree. And you don't even have to climb the tree to install the antenna. Altitude counts a lot. fight for altitude, fight to get the antenna as far above the ground as possible. The problem with the ground plane antenna is it's down at ground level. If you lived on top of a mountain, that's a beautiful antenna. Very few of us live on the top of that mountain. KB2, YEW, wait for the beep, K2RIW in the deck net.
Yeah, thanks guys for the info. Really appreciate it. I know there's no perfect antenna out there. I wish there was, like everybody else. Right now, I cut a dipole for 40 meters, and I was actually, the only way I was able to put it up on the roof, I couldn't string it up or I couldn't put it up in an inverted V. The only way I was able to put it was, and I know a lot of you guys are going to cringe out there, was I actually hot glue gunned it down to the shingles of the roof. And it went up one slope and down the other, and it circled the whole circumference of the house. And believe it or not, today when I got home and I passed my general, I bring up North Carolina three times, three different stations. I bring up Arkansas, and no problem on bringing up local stations on 40. It was definitely cut 440, and SWR was nil. It was nothing. It was excellent. So it actually worked. Now, I was just looking for something, you know, one or two or ten steps up from that, but you guys gave me a lot of information and a lot of things that I'm going to be searching out on the internet and trying to find some kind of other designs and stuff for. Thanks a lot, appreciate it, and I'll let this net continue. This is KB2YEW5D. Thanks, Rich, and thanks everybody else out on the net.
Make one more suggestion, Dick.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to suggest that you look at the antenna handbook of ARRL. You get a lot of suggestions out of that. The wire, hot glue down to the roof. We don't cringe at all. That's a very crafty idea. You can take a dipole where you don't have enough room, and you zigzag it, and it can work like a charm. You did the right thing. Over to you, Mel.
In there, quick. Yeah, that's where I got the idea from, ARRL. The one thing I did was hot glue gun it down to the roof, and obviously I hot glue gun the tip so it doesn't short out to anything. The longest center off the low loss coax was my longest run, and then I tried to make it around the circumference, and then I actually made it through the gutters of the house, so you really can't see it. I made it out of 14 gauge THHN wire. You know, which was should be some kind of resilient to the sun and any kind of elements out there. Back over to net, KB2YW5D.
That was the way I was finally able to take a comparison antenna, a dipole, and see that I could do better VX-wise on the low band if I could do low band VX. And the only way to achieve that was to go to this kind of extreme. Other than that, again, the dipole will give you the best bang for your buck. So that's the final words on it. Okay, Dick, where should we go from here? I think one other station called in. You want to pick them up? Over.
Yeah, that's what we're going to do right now. W2MIQ. Start off with your name, sir. And then your question or comment, if you've got one. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick.
This is KC2MIQ from Riverhead, Long Island. Name here is Charlie, and I just have two comments. One, this has been the most informative net I have ever listened to. That was the first comment. The second comment is, use porcelain instead of the plastic, because a lot of the plastic the plastic molded lines for the antennas are, don't ever buy black, only buy nylon color or white, because they make them overseas and sometimes they make them out of carbon. And that's the end of my comment. This is KC2, MIQ, and I'm clear.
Very fine, Charlie. Now that the geniuses at Limark are linking together the 147-375 machine with the 85 machine, and therefore the TechNet is coming over both, this TechNet has existed since 1982. We're in our 25 and a half year, our 25th year. I'm glad you're hearing it for the first time. Glad you're appreciating it. Obviously, you've got good taste, Charlie, out there in Riverhead. Okay, and yeah, I agree with you. When it comes to ultraviolet protection, it's hard to beat porcelain. Many of the plastics will deteriorate in time, suck up water, and do things that are not so nice, and have failure mechanisms. Porcelain doesn't do that. Maybe ultraviolet protected Delrin, black Delrin, is pretty good. And there are some plastics that are pretty good for outdoor, but I guess you're suggesting that we be a little bit careful on choosing that plastic and to get the longevity, to get our bang for the dollar of our hard-earned money. Okay, why don't you